Okay, so let me first thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk here. And I tell you a little bit about compactifications on generalized geometries. Now, although I will be a little more introductory, I will not really review the literature for you, and I will not really be able to make close contact with what Nigel told you yesterday. So this is at the end left as an exercise for you to combine, you know, to combine the two talks and make the connection. Rather, what I'll do, I will talk about two of my own papers, which were done in collaboration with Mariana Agrania, Sébastien Guéry, André Mico, and Daniel Waldron. So, if we look at string theory as strings moving in a 10-dimensional space-time background, then in order to make contact with our world, we need to compactify, or in other words, we need to choose to have it move in a background which is a 4-dimensional, flat, infinitely extended physical space-time times a compact 6-dimensional manifold. And it's the structure of the 6-dimensional manifold which, among other things, determines the amount of supersymmetry you see in this 4-dimensional space-time. And that actually has led to over many years, to a very fruitful interplay between supersymmetry and geometry. Now, our world, or particle physics, needs, in particular, or at least that's the belief at the moment, a spontaneously broken n=1 supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. Sorry? That's right, but I mean this is sort of the supersymmetric standard model. It's sort of one of the paradigms which are being looked at LHC, and that's really what I mean here. Now, traditionally, the way this is achieved is that you choose this 6-dimensional manifold to be a compact Calabi-Yau threefold, and then employ non-perturbative effects to break this n=1. This leads to n=1 supersymmetry, and then to break this n=1 supersymmetry by additional non-perturbative effects. Now, recently, there's a slight variation on this theme under the name of brain world scenarios, where you really fill the space-time with d-brains and orient defaults to make it consistent, and then spontaneously break the supersymmetry with background fluxes, generalized geometries, and possibly non-perturbative effects. Now, this is sort of the framework my talk is set in, although I will not really complete this entire project. Rather, I will just focus on background fluxes and generalized geometries. But of course, it's embedded, if you wish, in a bigger program, which I will not be able to present in all its entity. So, what is the purpose of this talk? I'd like to discuss mirror symmetry in the presence of background fluxes. That's the first topic, and then the second topic is I'd like to discuss compactifications on manifolds, which are called manifolds with SU3 structure. And in particular, in this part, I will compute the Kähler potential and the superpotential, and then try to uncover the role of torsion. These manifolds have torsion, and what is the supergravity or supersymmetry meaning of this torsion? Here's the outline. As a warm-up, I do Calabi-Yau compactifications of type 2 string theory. I discuss then background fluxes and mirror symmetry. I then go over to manifolds with SU3 structure, compute the Kähler potential and the superpotential, and then again pick up the discussion of mirror symmetry, and then I conclude with some open problems. Okay, type 2 string theories in 10 dimensions. These are the only string theories I discuss for today. They have 32 supercharges. And they come in two versions, type 2A, type 2B. The massless spectrum, they share in what is called the Nerve-Schwartz sector, a metric, a two-form with a three-form field strength, and a scalar, which is called the dilaton. They differ in what is called the Ramond-Ramond sector. Type 2A has a one-form and a three-form with a two-form and a four-form field strength, while the type 2B has a scalar, a second two-form, and a four-form with a self-dual five-form. Now, in the Nerve-Schwartz-Ramond sector, you have fermions, two gravitinos, and two dilatinos, and they differ in their chirality versus type 2A and versus type 2B. Now, if you compactify, you choose a space-time background like such, and then you decompose the fields into eigenfunctions of the Laplace operator on this six-dimensional manifold like here. And so you see that the eigenvalue of the six-dimensional Laplace operator corresponds from a four-dimensional perspective to the mass operator, and so the massless spectrum, the lowest-lying spectrum, corresponds to the zero modes of this Laplace operator. For Calabi-Yau manifolds, these zero modes are in one-to-one correspondence with the harmonic forms, which can be represented as elements in the Dolboko homology group of the Calabiau. Now, let's just a little review of Calabiau manifolds. These are Ricci flat Kähler manifolds with holonomy SU3. What is important for us here is that they have a globally defined spinner exists on this manifold, and this is intimately related to the existence of a supercharge in the four-dimensional space-time. Now, the number of these massless modes is determined, as we just said in the previous transparencies, by the Dolbeau cohomology, and they're counted by their dimensions, which are these Hodge numbers, and for the Calabiau threefold, this is usually arranged in this Hodge diamond, where the only non-trivial entries are the 1-1 forms, the 2-2 forms, and they're actually the same, and the 1-2 forms and the 2-1 forms, and they're actually also the same. So the two non-trivial numbers, the number of 1-1 forms and the number of 1-2 forms. In particular, these are related to deformations of the metric on this Calabiau manifold. These are moduli of the Calabiau manifold, and that's a certain subset of the scalar fields which will play an important role in this talk. And actually, these deformation, these moduli, span a space which turns out to be a product of two spaces. One are the deformation of the complex structure, and the other is the deformation of the Kähler form, of the complexified Kähler form, which is complexified. J is being the Kähler form here, and it's complexified with the B field, which exists in both theories, which is in the NS sector. So this is, yeah. Please.
You mean globally defined over a constant
span? Absolutely, yes. Yes, is missing. Absolutely, yes. Yeah, please interrupt me at any given moment, huh? So mirror symmetry, very briefly, the conjecture is that for every Calabiau manifold, there exists a mirror manifold, Y tilde, where the Hodge numbers are reversed. Or in other words, in this diamond, there is a symmetry. In this diamond I just showed you, there is a reflection symmetry along this axis, that this is interchanged and this is interchanged for the mirror, and that corresponds to the fact that the Euler number changes sign, so that the H11 of the Calabiau manifold is equal to the H12 of its mirror, and vice versa. And that mirror symmetry manifests itself in string theory by the fact that if I look at type 2A string theory in the background M4 times Y, then this is quantum equivalent to type 2B in the background, where you replace the Calabiau by its mirror. Now, it could be said much more about mirror symmetry. That would be a talk all by itself. But for now, that should be enough. And in fact, this in particular, this symmetry implies that the moduli spaces, which I just mentioned on the previous transparency, the deformation of the complex structure and the deformation of the complex Kähler form, should agree between, in the way it's written here, between the Calabiau and its mirror. Okay, now let's look at the low energy effective action of the massless modes. Now, this has n equal 2 supergravity, because I start with two supersymmetries in 10 dimension. I compactify it. One spinner exists on this Calabiau manifold, which leads to two supercharges in 4 dimensions. And then there is an effect. So, and then the effective action of the massless mode is described by an n equal 2 supergravity. So I've written, now we could write down the entire n equal 2 supergravity Lagrangian, but let me not do that. I only wrote 3 terms. There's the Einstein term in this 4-dimensional space-time action. Then there is the kinetic term for all the scalar fields. So Z are all the scalar fields, which include the deformations we just discussed, the deformation of the complex structure and the deformation of the Kähler form, plus other scalar fields which arise from the reduction, the Kaluza-Klein reduction of all these other fields in type 2A and type 2B, which I mentioned in this table. And then they have a sigma model type interaction with a metric here, GAB, which is the metric on the space of scalar fields. And then there's possibly a potential term for these scalar fields, plus other terms, which again depends a little bit on the details and which play no role in this talk. Now, this metric here is constrained by n equal 2 supergravity to, again, take the product form between a metric on a special Kähler geometry times a metric on a quaternionic Kähler geometry. Now, I don't want to really define these geometries for you. If you know what they are, then you know what they are. And and if you don't know what they are, well, you know, you won't learn it here now. But it's actually not so important. The important thing is that in there precisely sits this geometrical moduli space. So for type 2A, this special Kähler manifold, which is one of the components here, coincides with the geometrical moduli space of the deformations of the complexified Kähler form. That's the one of the spaces we discussed. And in type 2B, that special Kähler manifold is precisely the one for the deformations of the complex structure. And you see under mirror symmetry, these are precisely interchanged exactly as we said. So what that means is really that these two spaces have to be what are called special geometries, and indeed they are. Now this quaternionic Kähler manifold has a structure that in there sits a subspace. So this is of dimension 4 times H1, 2 plus 1. And in there sits a subspace of dimension 2H1 plus 2, which is precisely, again, this space of complex structure deformation. So this quaternionic Kähler manifold is not the most general one. It has a subspace, which is, again, a special Kähler manifold. And actually, the rest of the scalar fields to make up this missing dimension here are sort of trivially fibered over this geometrical moduli space because they arise largely from the Ramon-Ramon sector. So the music, all I'm trying to say here. Yeah. So here, I'm talking about the classical, the entire talk is about the classical situation. So what I'm trying to say is the music plays in these two spaces, and indeed they appear in the sigma model in the sigma model metric of the effective n equal to supergravity. And now you can compute, and they are both Kähler manifolds, that means, so they're both Kähler manifolds, and you can compute the Kähler potential, and here I give you the Kähler potential. So for the deformation of the complex of the Kähler form, this is just given by the integral over J cubed, J being the Kähler form, and for the deformation of the complex structure, it's just omega vec omega bar, where omega is the holomorphic 3 form, and again, it's integrated over the Calabi-Yau manifold. Okay.
I mean, without
Absolutely, I'm sorry. So in terms of mirror, this, of course, they can only be the same only if you indeed include quantum correction. So in that sense, I was not quite precise in the saying that mirror symmetry only is true if quantum corrections are included, absolutely. Not really. I mean, I don't know. Say that again.
You mentioned that
yes.
That's the
leading
order in the supergravity.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. The picture that this sits in here, they don't spoil. So now, no, but they don't spoil. No. No, that stays actually exactly the same. There will be space-time instanton corrections here to both of these. So perturbative space-time correction, but not alpha prime correction. I think everything stays here the way it is. The correction will be to the pre-potential, if you wish, of these two geometries. But so the quantum correction enter these two geometries, but the way these other scalar fields are fibered over it stays the same. Okay. Now we're coming to introducing background fluxes in this situation. So what are background fluxes? So we take some of these field strengths, which we have in type 2B. So let's call it FP for any P form. So that's a P form field strength. And we integrate it over a non-trivial cycle inside the Calabi-Yau manifold. And we ask, or we make this integral to not vanish. And that's what we call EI. It has an index I depending on over which cycle here we integrate. And we want to do that such that the Bianchi identity and the equation of motion remains intact. Or in other words, we want that this FP is actually a constant times a harmonic form which is dual to this cycle. So this is often what we call the background flux here, this non-trivial number which we can turn on. Now, these fluxes are quantized in string theory, but in the low-energy approximation which I'm using here, they can be thought of as a continuous deformation of the supergravity. Now, string theory, of course, imposes a consistency condition of turning them on, which often goes under the name of the tadpole cancellation condition. And really, in order to, what I'm doing, embed in a consistent string vacuum, you really have to make sure that all of this is taken care of. And somehow I will not discuss it, but I will assume the whole time that there's, you know, you do that, you complete the story by making this into a consistent string theory.
What about H-blocks? Are you going to be turning on H-blocks?
Of course. Right? Yes. Sorry? Then you mean here, these? Yeah, of course. So we will do both of these we will do. So let me just, so at the moment here I'm just doing a sort of a general, you know, a general discussion, and then we go to the particular case. So so what happens if we take the Calabi-Yau manifold to be large, that's sort of the low energy approximation, the supergravity approximation, that allows us to consider these fluxes as a small perturbation such that the light spectrum does not change. So I want to make sure that these fluxes do not generate masses which are of the order of the string modes alpha, you know, order alpha prime, which I've integrated out in the low energy description. So this is the first aspect. Then, of course, what it does, these fluxes deform the low-energy supergravity into what is called a gauged or massive supergravity. And we will see on the next transparency, they introduce gauged charges and or masses for some of the fields. They generate a potential, and that leads to a lifting of the vacuum degeneracy. All these theories so far I've discussed in the Calabi-Yau, there was no potential for these scalar fields, so there was a continuous vacuum degeneracy which is unfortunate for all sort of the physical prediction of the theory. So one would like to lift this vacuum degeneracy, and so this is a way to really do this by turning on these fluxes. And then generically, at the minimum of this potential, supersymmetry is spontaneously broken. So this is sort of the generic story. And now let's look at fluxes in type 2b on the Calabi-Yau. So in type 2b, what you usually turn on is a three-form flux. So type 2-3 has two three-forms, F3 in the Ramond-Ramond sector, H3 in the Neuve-Schwartz sector, tau is the complexified dilaton, so it's made of the two, the dilaton and the scalar in the Ramond-Ramond sector. And then you can consider non-trivial integrals over this three-form here, and that again you would call the flux. And now there is a distinction, please. Sorry?
Are you adding something else?
Say that again? So I don't understand the question.
In order to obtain a minimum rate supersymmetry that you were just referring to, there should be a negative term.
Absolutely. I mean, really, that's what I'm saying. You know, to really sort of, you know, you generate this potential, you need to study that question, you need to do all the, you know, you need to satisfy the tadpole cancel, you need to embed this into a consistent string theory, which I'm not doing here. Yeah, absolutely. For example, absolutely, to really discuss it. But I will not discuss this issue here. Huh? But sort of this is the physical motivation, that why are we interested in turning on fluxes? Because it opens up the possibility to break supersymmetry. So, yeah.
Is it consistent to turn on only the fluxes and analyze the fluxes without at the same time including their intervals? Couldn't they change
the potentials you're going to compute and so on? Yeah, so in some sense I'm presenting the first step toward in that program. Absolutely. And then we have to see what happens when I put on the orientifold and so on. The reason why I'm doing this is that in here, of course, I have the whole power of n equal 2 at the moment, and I just want to get as much mileage out as I can out of n equal 2. And then we'll do the orientifold projection and all of the rest of it and see what remains. And that's, you know, that absolutely has to be done. So it's, if you wish, the first step in this program. And I will not complete this here. I will leave it at that level.
But if we know you want to compact everything, it's fine. We don't even have to worry.
Yeah, but that's right. Go, yeah.
But how are you dealing with tadpoles? In this context, if you put a general three-form flux on,
yes,
F will give you
five-form flux. Absolutely, yes. So, that's right.
So, how do you look at that question?
So I would just leave it as it is at the moment and not discuss that, and say if I want to now embed this, want to pick up a consistent string vacuum, then I have to solve this equation. And then I will get additional...
That's necessary for consistent super
gravity. So that's fine. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So if you wish, I'm leaving at that moment. I'm just turning on the fluxes. And I'm not worrying right now about of getting a solution of the supergravity equation. I'm just turning on the fluxes.
Can you say that you're just working on non-compact manifold? And
sorry?
Working on non-compact manifold.
And well, this is we could ask whether this is whether any of the results I get make sense at the end. That is the thing you could get could be worried about. Does it make sense to discuss the n equal 2 before I do the orientifold projection, or will I get complete nonsense? And my claim is I will get sensible results, but it might not have a stable ground state, it might have a runaway solution, and things like that. So this is why I don't like to do that.
Maybe what you're doing is you're working off-shell. You're just taking the supergravity Lagrangian and working off-shell.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm not. Yeah.
So I'm.
That's Gauss's law, right?
Well,
it's pretty hard one to
then, but he's working class. Gauss's law comes from.
In some sense, it's the equation of more.
Sorry?
You can take integral h1 down equals 0.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And exactly. Yeah. And in some sense I don't care. I could also look at domain wall solutions. At the moment I will look at domain wall solutions. So I'm not really care. I'm not solving the equations of motion yet. Huh? I'm turning on the background flux. Okay. Where was I? Huh? So here are these two fluxes. So I expand them along H3, which is the third cohomology, and on H3, on a six-dimensional manifold, you have a natural symplectic structure. So every three-form is dual again to a three-form, and the similar thing is true for the cycles. So I can actually there's a natural symplectic structure on the set of cycles on H3, and that allows me to make a distinction between two types of fluxes, which I call electric and magnetic. And at the moment, of course, this is a little bit arbitrary, but indeed, if I do the expansion of the four-form in type 2b along H3, I will get two gauge bosons. One is an electric one is the dual magnetic one, and it is the expansion around, you know, that set of three forms or that set of three forms. And then the self-duality condition of the five form tells me that these two gauge bosons are dual to each other. So I choose one of them to call electric and the other one to call magnetic, and that identifies to me a set of electric cycles and a set of magnetic cycles, and I call the equivalent fluxes here electric and magnetic. So this is what the word electric and magnetic means. But there is a convention which I fix in C4 when I define what is the photon and what is the dual photon. Okay, so if you turn these on and now you do the Kaluza-Klein reduction of the 10-dimensional type 2b supergravity, what these fluxes do is the electric fluxes will gauge certain translational isometries in these hypermultiplet moduli spaces, in this quaternionic Kähler manifold. And in particular, sort of the covariant derivatives will be, the ordinary derivatives will be replaced by covariant derivatives, where really this flux plays the role of a gauge charge here. Now, for the magnetic fluxes, that is a little different. This usually turns into what is called a massive supergravity. So some of the fields, some of the two-form fields, B2 and C2, will really become massive. So there's a mass, there's sort of a Stückelberg mechanism.
What does it mean to depend?
This is just the killing vector for this isometry, and so this is the general formula. And this case here is just this integral. Huh? Okay. Now both of these supergravities induce a potential, and this potential is determined in terms of some moral equivalent of a superpotential. And for this case, this is this superpotential Sergei has proposed, which is this integral of omega, the holomorphic free-form wedge, the flux. So this is what you find in this case. Okay. Now we could ask the question about mirror symmetry when we do that. And we can in a moment ask whether this is a sensible question or not. But let's ask the question. So let's do the same thing on the type 2B side and the type 2A side. And then I first look at the Ramond-Ramond sector. So on the Ramond-Ramond sector, we had the electric and the magnetic fluxes, which now only include integrals over F3, which is the three form, the Ramond-Ramond three form. And then you have on the type 2A side, you have a four form and a two form, and under mirror symmetry, these precisely go to each other, match to each other. If you look at the mirror, you compactify type 2A on the mirror manifold, then you get a nice match between these electric fluxes and the magnetic fluxes. And you can check this at the level of the effective action, that the effective action precisely agrees. If you make this identification, you identify the electric fluxes, you identify these magnetic fluxes like here, and you choose a mirror pair, you compactify this on the mirror pair of manifolds. So in the Ramond-Ramond sector, everything is fine. Now in the NS sector, things become more complicated. This is a little bit what Greg hinted already at. So there's no obvious mirror symmetry in the NS sector, because in the NS sector, of course, F3 complexifies, which H3, which is, it's an unfortunate notation, but it's also along the third cohomology, H upper 3 here. And that is, they share this on both sides. So type 2A and type 2B have something along H3, but nothing along the even cohomologies here, H2 or H4. So there are really electric and magnetic fluxes to complete the mirror symmetry in the NS sector. So, and they're missing on both sides. And there isn't anything in the NS sector other than the three form and the metric. So they only come, the mirror of these NS fluxes can only come from the metric, or in other words, from geometry. And this was first suggested by Kumrun, that he said, well, you know, in order to complete mirror symmetry, you really have to compactify on a different geometry, which will lead to these fluxes. Yes?
So I know you're going to tell us about the proposals for mirrors, but would there have been anything profoundly wrong if the statement was simply that once you turned on a flux, you didn't have a mirror?
Mirror?
Is there some argument that couldn't be in there?
Yeah. We'll come to that. Huh? Okay. So.
When you turn on H fluxes, you turn on, isn't the sigma model, the 0-2 sigma model, and the 2-2 sigma model?
Sorry?
Turn on H and S flux?
I'm sorry?
If you have a compactification,
yes,
where you turn a three-form NS flux, isn't in general the sigma model the 0-2 sigma model?
Model, something like that, yes.
But the argument about mirror symmetry doesn't rely on having the 2-2 sigma model?
Well, it needs to be modified. That's sort of what we're getting at now. So in order, let's try to discover this geometry. So let us first recall how the Calabi-Yau condition was derived. So I'll go a little bit through the derivation of the Calabi-Yau condition with you. So the Lorentz, in this background here, in this product background, the Lorentz group splits, the Lorentz group of the 10-dimensional space-time splits into these two products, and the spinner representation of the 10-dimensional Lorentz group splits accordingly, like such. And then what Gary and his friends did way, way back, they imposed two conditions. I mean, they imposed one condition, but you can sort of split it up in two conditions. They first demanded that a supercharge exists. That means there should be a globally defined spinner on this manifold, and that leads to the reduction of the structure group of this. You need a reduction of the structure group of this six-dimensional manifold. That means that this four-dimensional representation has to split into a triplet plus a singlet, which happens precisely if the structure group reduces from SO6 to SU3. And so if this, and this singlet here is the globally defined spinner, and if this globally defined spinner exists, then the and this is a situation which is discussed in the mathematical literature, and then the mathematicians call this that Y6 has SU3 structure. That means really that there's a manifold on which a globally defined spinner, a singlet under, that there's a reduction of the structure group and that a globally defined spinner exists on this manifold. And physically that means that with this spinner we can define a supercharge, a well-defined supercharge. Now the second aspect of this, now of the argument, is that you impose that the supersymmetry, that the background preserves supersymmetry. So you look at the supersymmetry transformation of the fermions, which has two terms. One is the covariant derivative of the supersymmetry parameter, plus a bunch of terms which include the field strength, these field strengths of the gauge potentials, and this is a little bit symbolic. It's much more complicated. John knows about all of this. You know, this is a long equation here with all these potentials, and so there's some sum of p-form field strength appropriately dotted into a product of anti-symmetrized gamma matrices. And I just abbreviate this like this term here, which stands for all of these terms, and which is different from for type 2a and type 2b. Sorry. Absolutely, that's a typo. It acts on eta, of course. Huh? So let me just conclude the argument. So then if you say that F is zero, there's no background flux, then this term is zero. And then in order to preserve this equation, you say that this one spinner, this singlet spinner, has to be covariantly constant, and that leads to a Calabi-Yau manifold, the condition of the Calabi-Yau manifold.
What's the difference between structure group and
So the structure group is the group which acts on the frame bundle. So there's, you patch the manifold up with these various frames, and it's the group which leads to which the transformation from frame to frame sits in. And that can be different. That's the crucial thing.
No, so
it's only
no reference to the metric.
Yeah, and that actually coincides precisely when that spinner is covariantly constant. That distinction vanishes when the spinner is covariantly constant. Then the structure group is the holonomy group.
But in point one here, there's no mention of any connection. That's important, right?
At the moment, well, we will mention a connection at the in a.
In this condition one, there's no connection with the cancel block. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes.
You're saying that there is a spinner that can form the same. The transition function was an SC3.
Yeah.
It's just saying that globally there's a spinner that's a symbol under those transition functions.
Yeah.
Or it's among the transition functions, you can always pick transition functions.
Probably that's a good question. I don't know. I haven't thought about the non-supersymmetric case. Once you have that, you have supersymmetry.
Well, I think we always have fermions, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Absolutely. No, that's right. Yeah. That is stronger than having fermions. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, are you talking about the first or the second condition? You're talking about the first condition.
I'm just being slow, but I understand the second condition is a condition for Maslow's gravity.
Yes. The symmetry, that's right. The first condition may massive gravitino and particularly spontaneously broken supersymmetry, absolutely. But it would say that the supercurrent exists. Huh? That's sort of the difference. This is what the first condition ensures. Yeah. Exactly. I thought about it a little bit. We can discuss it afterwards. Let me not, because I have the answer for you. We talked about this yesterday. So let's discuss this over tea, otherwise we're getting... Okay. So now, how can you generalize it? You don't want a monkey with one. Sorry.
I thought you meant the spinner is supposed to know where we're vanishing. Did you do that?
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's what I mean.
But it's important, otherwise it would be just any spinner.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is what the mathematicians mean with a globally defined spinner. It's nowhere vanishing. Nowhere vanishing.
Just the existence of spinners.
Absolutely. That's why I said a globally defined spinner. Yeah. Okay. Nowhere vanishing. Okay. Okay. But I believe. Okay. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. But I think this is also what they mean when they talk about SU3 structure. They mean the existence of a nowhere vanishing spinner.
I mean,
That's the definition, I believe.
Very short then. You can have a spinner bundle, but you also may want to have a nowhere vanishing section, which.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, while we're asking, what does structured root mean here? Just a normal parallel transport defined by the metric or something?
Just what he just explained it. Yeah.
But that don't you, does it refer to going to a little bit of metric or something? Is there any bus backgrounds?
Yes. I would draw my statement that there's no, that the metric is completely invisible.
Okay, that's what it is.
That's good. To have an SO6 as the structure group.
It's the local Lorentz connection, right?
Yes.
You don't need to set to impose any condition on eta with respect to the metric. But you can't talk about it. Otherwise it would be GL6 instead of SO6 as the structure group. Let's not go there.
Maybe I remind you of that we will have a little study group on this so we can discuss all of these. And we have an organizational meeting after tea in the small seminar room here, so to understand it a little better. Huh? All right, now I want to generalize. I don't want to monkey with one. I don't want to get rid of n equal 2 supergravity, but I'm considering to relax this condition. Huh? So this is the generalization. So we're talking about SU3 structure, but the spinner is no longer covariantly constant. And I can do this in two ways. I can do it in such a way that I turn on flux and turn on here the covariant derivative such that, again, the background is supersymmetric. Or I could even consider that of not doing that, so having a spontaneously broken supersymmetry. For what follows, I don't really care which case I'm talking about here. I only want to study this situation now, the situation where the spinner is not covariantly constant. So in other words, I want to study compactifications on manifolds with SU3 structure, which means the spinner is there, but it's not covariantly constant. And then, okay, that's really what I will do for the rest of this talk, to discuss this situation. Now, in fact, we could be slightly more general, and that now makes contact with what Nigel talked about yesterday. In fact, I have two spinners in 10 dimensions, two gravitinos, one in the left, one in the right moving sector. And in principle, I could ask when I do the reduction that I have two independent spinners on the manifold. Both are not covariantly constant. But one which, so each of them makes up for one of the gravitinos in 4 dimensions so that I have an n equal 2. But these two spinners don't have to be the same. Or in other words, they don't have to be parallel. They could be really different. And this is what the mathematicians, I'm not sure who invented the word, but this is what the mathematicians call, or Nigel calls, SU3 times SU3 structure. So then each of these two spinners defines an SU3 structure, and together they define an SU3 times SU3 structure.
Would there be Ramon-Ramon fields terminal?
Sorry?
When you look at the Ramon-Ramon fields, they usually mix to left and right.
No, and at the moment I'm just saying I could consider compactifications on manifolds which have two spinners, which, I mean, in the Calabi-Yau case, you have only one spinner, and both 10-dimensional gravitinos are expanded in terms of the same spinner. Now I can have actually two different spinners in the left and the right moving sector.
Yeah, this is what I was saying. The equation could mix them, but yeah. The two exist as different.
Exactly. And now the situation could be that they are never parallel over the entire manifold, that they're always parallel, or they are parallel at a finite number of points. So these are the three situations, again, which we could discuss in terms. And again, it will lead to three very different situations. So this is what, but I will not really, this is some of the things we're working on right now, and I'm pretty confused, so I will not talk much about this case, but of course I'm happy to. All right, so let's do manifolds with SU3 structure. Which is really what was discussed a long time. I think Gray started in the early 70s to discuss weak holonomy, and that's basically what he did. So once we have that invariant spinner, that implies actually the existence of two invariant tensors, call them J and omega, a two-form which you can build from bilinears of the spinners by appropriately contracting with an anti-symmetrized product of gamma matrices. And this is precisely the same definition of as it is in the Calabi-Yau case for the Kähler form. The only difference now is it's not a Kähler form, it's not closed, precisely because that spinner is not covariantly constant. If I raise one of these indices with a metric, then you can show that this is squares to minus 1, so it defines an almost complex structure, but it's 9 whose tensor does not vanish, so it's not a complex structure. Nevertheless, with respect to this almost complex structure, this J is of type 1-1. Similarly, you can construct this 3 form, a 3-0 form with respect to this complex structure, by wedging 3 gamma by contracting 3 gamma matrices with these 2 spinners. And again, that 3 form is not closed. Now, you normalize these spinners to 1, for example, and then Fiat's identities imply that actually the cube of J is equal to omega veg omega bar, precisely the same condition as it is in the Calabi-Yau case, and that J veg omega is equal to 0. So this you just get. And this is just implied by the existence of that spinner. The difference from the Calabi-Yau case is only that these two forms, omega and J, are no longer closed. So you can alternatively define manifolds of SU3 structure by the existence of precisely these two forms, J and omega, with these conditions. That's another way of the definition of manifolds of SU3 structure. Now, if I do SU3 times SU3 structure, I have a pair. Now I have 2 spinners, so I have a pair of J's and a pair of omega. Okay. All right. Now, what are the further properties? What you can show is actually that this spinner is always annihilated or is covariantly constant with respect to another connection, not the Levi-Civita connection, but a connection which differs from the Levi-Civita connection by a piece which is called the intrinsic torsion. So you show that the spinner satisfies this equation, and the amount it differs from the Levi-Civita connection is known as the intrinsic torsion. It's almost a torsion, but actually the torsion splits into a piece, into the intrinsic torsion plus another piece, and the intrinsic torsion is the piece which survives in this general equation when it's acting on an SU3 singlet here. Just this just takes into account that it is sort of a singlet of the structure group. Is the rest of it. So the entire torsion splits into a piece which is called the invariant torsion, which is the piece which survives here just because it acts on a singlet, and Tg is the rest. Now you can decompose T0 into representations of SU3. Let me spare you the group theory here, but you actually find 5 representations. It decomposes into 5 irreducible representations of SU3, and they are written here. These are the representations. This is sort of these are the components of the torsion. These are denoted by the components of the torsion. This is all taken from a paper by Chiossi and Salamon. And then you can interpret from this equation, you can actually re-express by using this equation, you can re-express the torsion always in terms of d omega, right? D omega and dj. Or in other words, if I compute dj and d omega with the help of this equation, I can relate it to this intrinsic torsion. So the intrinsic torsion is entirely, there's a little work to do, but is entirely expressed in terms of dj or d omega. And this is given in this table here. So various components of dj and d omega correspond to these different classes, torsion classes, which again are labeled by different SU3 representations. So in other words, dj and d omega is equivalent to the intrinsic torsion. This is all from the math literature. All right, now we're coming back to our question of what are the mirrors of Calabi-Yau with electric flux, with NS flux, and let's first focus on electric fluxes. So the result is, let me first give you the result, and then I'll discuss the proof. So the result is that this manifold is, and again, this manifold already had appeared in the mathematical literature, and it's called a half-flat manifold. I believe Nigel discussed it for the first time, but I'm not sure he called it half-flat. It might be somebody else called it half-flat later on. Anyway, we found this manifold in the math literature, and it's defined by the following equations. These are these torsion classes from the beginning. So it says particularly that W4 and W5 are zero, and that on W2 and W1 and W2 there is a reality condition, so the imaginary part vanishes. This is what is written here, and or this can be expressed, as we said, in terms of condition on omega and J, and that says that actually the imaginary part of omega is closed and that J squared is closed. These are the two conditions, and that satisfy a class of manifolds which are called half-flat manifolds. And now we found that precisely the missing four-form flux. This is exactly what the electric flux chorus we are looking for, an NS4 form, because that's what we need for an electric flux, is precisely the real part of omega. So the imaginary part of omega, or the D of the real part of omega, the imaginary part of omega is zero by this equation, but the real part is not zero. It's a four-form. Its coefficient we could call the flux, the NS flux, and that's precisely the looked-for mirror. At least that's the proposal. Sorry?
So real omega is not globally well defined? It looks like F4 is exact.
Well, it's sort of like a field strength. Right on the other side, it's also, well.
So it has no period.
What?
I don't understand. I mean, usually when people write E, I, omega, I.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
This thing looks like it's globally
half. Absolutely, yes. Here, because this omega 4 is D of something. Yes.
So this flux has no period.
That
integrate on a closed cycle.
So the, well, yeah, so, okay. So the, this is, so, the, yes, so the yeah.
Well,
so
yeah, I think what you're saying is the interesting geometrical object is this, what the real omega, or sorry, yeah, well,
what
the
is
real omega,
so,
but it's not really a flux.
Yeah.
So what is omega 4i?
Okay.
What is omega 4? Is this an element of cohomology?
No, obviously not, because it's exact, huh?
It's I.
So, exactly. So this is actually one of my puzzles which I wrote here. Let me just, so the question is, let me just this go through the proof, and then I tell you why this is a troublesome equation, huh? With your permission, let me do it that way, huh? Then it's better to discuss this. So how did we? So let's put this in quotation marks here. So I'm not pretending I understand this completely. Huh? So let me tell you what we did. So first of all, how did we derive this? The first thing is we went to the SYZ limit. Where you can do mirror symmetry explicitly, because mirror symmetry is just T-duality. Huh? We did this, and you find precisely this geometry here. So on the SYZ limit, you precisely determine that the mirror is this half-flat manifold.
So electric flux means that H doesn't have any legs along the three mirrors?
Yes. Then what you can do is you can match the domain wall solutions. This would be my answer to some of the questions before. So if you now look at not four-dimensional Minkowski background, but domain wall backgrounds, then in precisely this type 2B Calabi-Yau with fluxes does have n equal 1 BPS domain wall solutions, and these are really honest string solutions. And for example, you could find them in this paper. And now you can match them with a type 2A solution, which really Nigel computed. He determined the domain wall solution of type 2A of this. Of course, he did this in a very different language. He asked the following question. He's asked what a six-dimensional manifold, if I fiber that over an interval such that the seven-dimensional manifold has G2 holonomy, what does the six-dimensional fiber have to be? And he found precisely this geometry. And this is actually how we were led to this, huh, by his work. That precise, so that was clear, there is an n equal 1 BPS domain wall solution there in this geometry. If you choose this manifold, the six-dimensional manifold, to be half flat. And so together with the domain wall solution, you really have an n equal 1 supersymmetry, which is what the G2 ensures. So this is the second check. And the third check is the computation of the low energy effective action on this Y manifold, which is what I want to do for the last 10 minutes. I want to discuss with you how to compute now the low energy effective action. So what is the puzzles I have? The puzzle so far is, again, this only works for electric fluxes and not for the magnetic fluxes. So this is the one puzzle, which we believe has to do with SU3 times SU3 structure. The other puzzle is what that equation really means. So first of all, so here is some four-form, and it nicely complexifies the four-form from the Ramon-Ramon sector. But it is counted, so in order to make that match, it has to be counted in terms of the Calabi-Yau cohomology. So this index has to run, in order to make the match, this index has to coincide with the cohomology of the Calabi-Yau, or more precisely, of the mirror of the Calabi-Yau. And so there is this equation knows something. It's not an equation in cohomology, exactly because this is exact.
Actually, you're not interested in cohomology because your H flux is not turned on. So you want D plus H. You want twisted cohomology.
Well, so, yes.
I mean, maybe this is not trivial in twisted cohomology.
See, that could be, yes.
The correct differential when the H flux is turned on is D plus H.
H, yes.
Yeah. So the fluxes should be D plus H closed. And
yeah.
Greg, this is supposed to be the mirror of the H turned on.
He does have H because otherwise he couldn't have done the two duality.
The end of the two duality, you don't have H anymore.
But on this manifold, I have no H flux here. On this manifold, there's no H flux. The H flux is gone. H is on the one side, and now I do mirrors. Symmetry. I do T.
Sorry, I'm totally lost. So you have a T3 vibration.
Yes.
Space.
Yes.
H. I asked you where the legs were, and you said they were on the face.
So this was on the Calabi-Yau side. So now I do T duality. I go to the mirror, and H is gone. It all goes into geometry. Huh? So there's only metric on the other side.
If H didn't have indices along the
let me backtrack. I'm not sure exactly how the indices, but there is a certain choice of the indices, which I now cannot remember exactly.
If H is along the base.
Yeah, but so I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure. Maybe it has one leg on the fiber and two on the base, something like that.
Oh.
So I don't really exactly. There's a certain combination which I now don't have handy here.
It's in your paper.
Yeah, it's in the paper. It probably has one. Anyway, there is a.
Like on the fiber, because you can't. I mean, the first T duality in that direction, you can handle, and then luckily H is gone away, so you can do that.
Exactly.
You
have two
legs on the fiber, you get in a commutative geometry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why magnetic is harder, precisely.
This isn't non trivial, this H flux is.
It's non trivial on this. On the Calabi-Yau, on the type 2B side, but now I'm going over to the type 2A side.
So the base has a two cycle on it?
The base is a three cycle.
Yeah,
it's H3 over these two cycles.
No, but you said it has one leg in the.
Locally. Mm-hmm. Just a local decomposition.
Well, but that has to be true globally in some sense.
I'm not sure I understand the question here.
What is the three cycle on H?
Well, I don't have it handy right now. I'm sorry. So this is the.
Maybe it's just not non-trivial. In which case, I mean, Greg's point that this is exact.
That's right. Depending on what H is, the twisted cohomology might be trivial on the TB side and trivial on the 2A side.
Yeah, that could be. Although we checked that a little bit, and at the time we didn't. We could try to look at it again. In any case, the thing which I don't understand here is what is the relation between the precise. I mean, there must be a relation between this half flat geometry and the mirror of the Calabi-Yau. And the fact, of course, that this is exact here is related to the fact that on the mirror, that precisely the turning on the flux moves zero modes out of the cohomology. Something becomes massive. So this is, of course, physically it's clear that it should not be in cohomology because precisely what the fluxes do, they move states out of the cohomology. Some of the zero modes cease to be zero modes, the cohomology is depleted. And here we see the same thing in geometry. On the other hand, we saw it by turning on the flux, and here we see it through geometry. Okay, let me just, because my time is running short, let me come to the computation of the effective action, which actually I think is interesting from a completely different point of view. So the question that I'd like to ask is, how do we do it? The trouble is a little bit we had is because suddenly there is no clear distinction anymore between zero modes and light modes, because we don't know how, what is the modes you want to keep and what are the modes you want to integrate over. And then there is the question, what is the relation between, as I said, between these manifolds?
Can you say roughly what the size of the various
Well, the gaps are?
Well, you know this, if with the flux, of course, you can tune. Huh? So the question is, how do you do this? The same thing in geometry? The fluxes I just dial, how can you do the same thing in geometry? So I must keep some. I keep the zero modes, but now I need to keep some of the non-zero modes in the geometry. Yeah, which is exactly. So this is a little bit the problem. I really would need the massive spectrum, and then sort of in a well-defined way truncate that. So at beginning it looks hopeless, to really do that. So then, of course, we ask the question: what are these other manifolds which are not half flat? Half flat had these particular conditions, and then, of course, there was the question of the meaning of torsion. Now, let me give you the answers. So, how did we do this? Actually, we rewrote the 10-dimensional supergravity in an n equal 2 form, and then truncated. And so, this is what I'd like to tell you, and then. And then actually we found that these other manifolds can be similarly used as compactification manifolds. Half flat only appeared because of my particular problem of looking for the mirror of NS fluxes, but all these other manifolds are probably equally good compactification manifolds. And again, then the torsion will just determine the potential. And the intuition is, of course, that D in the effective action, what appears the torsion will express as D omega and DJ. And that cannot appear in the kinetic terms, because in the kinetic terms, the two derivatives are already taken up by space-time derivatives. So there's no room to take d omega and dj. So d omega and doj can only appear in the potential. So the kinetic terms must be almost unchanged. All right, so let's see how we did this. So we considered a 10-dimensional space-time background with a weird Lorentz group. So it has a Lorentz group SO13 times SU3. And this is very much reminiscent of much earlier work by David and Nikolai, where they also rewrote the 10-dimensional supergravities. In fact, they rewrote the 11-dimensional supergravity in a background which has a funny Lorentz group. So let's do the same thing here, but we don't do the reduction. We work the same time in 10 dimensions, but we have a space-time which breaks the Lorentz group. And now we can decompose the 10-dimensional fields according to the representation of this Lorentz group. And now if we truncate away all triplets, which basically ensures that out of the 8 gravitinos you have, or out of the 8 gravitinos of this, when I now say 8, I mean the 8 gravitinos I have with respect to this part of the Lorentz group, this ensures that only 2 survive, which are in the gravitational multiplet, or in other words, you ensure that this 10-dimensional supergravity looks like an n equal 2 in 4 dimensions. But it's not truncated yet. It has the entire Kaluza-Klein tower in it. And if you do this, then in fact the 10-dimensional fields nicely arrange in n equal 2 multiplets of this part of the Lorentz group.
How do you know that this gives any consistent picture of the low energy effective field theory?
Not yet. So far we are just rewriting the 10-dimensional theory. We are decomposing the 10-dimensional fields. That's right. So in particular, sort of, we're truncating the triplets. So this we could do by geometry, say, by choosing a background which doesn't allow any triplets, or by making some orientifold projection or so. But we could probably take them along, because they would come in massive spin 3 half multiplets. So it's probably not a big deal, but let's just focus on this. And then, so what did we do? For example, the metric we decomposed into, you know, the mu nu are the indices of SO13. Mu is the index of SU13, so this is a gravitational multiplet. But its lowest component in the Kaluza-Klein reduction will be the 4-dimensional, you know, gravitational multiplet. But here it has the entire tower in it. All of depends on all 10 fields. So we can do this now. We can go through all the fields and just classify them or arrange them by their SU3 representation. So for example, this is the 8 plus 3 here, so this is the piece of the metric here, the internal metric, the metric with indices M and N, and this decomposes into a representation which is 8 plus 1 and into a representation which is 6. So together this is 15, which is precisely the degrees of freedom of a metric. And here you have the B field, which sits in the 8 plus 1 and so on and so forth. So just by SU3 representation, you can group the 10-dimensional fields into n equal 2 multiplets. And now you can plug this in, the 10-dimensional action. Let me just do this for the NS sector. I only do this for the NS sector. So here I have the 10-dimensional NS sector, the Einstein plus the square of the H of the 3 form plus the dilaton. And now I rewrite this as if I were to compactify. So I rewrite this in terms of a 4-dimensional metric, which I've rescaled with the dilaton, in terms of a 4-dimensional dilaton, which I've shifted by the log of the determinant of this GMN, and so, and a Weyl rescale, and so on and so forth. But I never do the Kaluza-Klein truncation. I do everything in 10 dimensions, but I sort of massage the 10-dimensional effective action as if it were an n equal to 1. And so you get a piece which is entirely a singlet. This is this piece, which will correspond to the universal sector. And then I will have a piece where the derivative sort of the internal metric and the internal B field appears, and there will be some coefficient out in front. This is precisely the same term you would have in Kaluza-Klein, in Kaluza-Klein reduction of the Calabi-Yau manifold. You would precisely have that same term. And now you interpret this as the kinetic term and this as the metric on the space of metric and B field deformation. So this, if you wish, is now a metric on this space of metric and B-field deformations, where B-field and metric deformations are defined by SU3 group theory. And now you can show that this metric here is a product of special geometries, entirely in 10 dimensions. It really splits into two pieces, and you can compute the Kähler potential. Now the Kähler potential is actually a 6 form, and it again appears, it has precisely the same form as for the Calabi-Yau. It's the cube of J and omega wedge omega bar, but it's not integrated over because I haven't done the integral here.
But G and mu to zero, are just dropping the triplets?
Absolutely. But exactly. Otherwise, I wouldn't have that because, of course, I would have spin 3/2 multiplets in the game. And then, of course, the n equal 2 would have very different rules. So this is why that was crucial, if I really want this. But really, this is... And now, why do we... Now, of course, there's a little computation you have to do to get these Kähler potential. Why did this all work? Because, of course, I can do precisely the same computation Candelas and Strominger did when they computed this for the Calabi-Yau case. And if you go through their proof, you see that they never used the fact that the spinner was covariantly constant. They only used the existence. And so this actually follows only from the existence of the spinner, but you never needed to use that there is a covariantly constant spinner.
This may well not be the correct kinetic action, for example, because you may not be solving the 10-dimensional equations with this computation, right? How do you know that you're going to have a solution with the 10D equations once you've done this truncation?
I'm not sure.
And in particular, if you throw away the MU component of the metric. Maybe somehow it is.
Maybe it applies from there too.
I think you can make them self-consistent into zero.
Yeah, I would also think it's possible. I'm running late. We will discuss a little more. And then you can do the same thing for the potential, And so the potential we computed by actually looking at the supersymmetry transformation of the gravitino, which it has in n equal 2 has this particular form. It's the covariant derivative of a supersymmetry parameter, pi times a term, which actually is here a matrix, an SU2 matrix, which is the n equal 2 moral equivalent of the superpotential. In n equal 1, the superpotential would be here. And again, the n equal 2 people expanded this SU2 matrix in terms of a triplet of what is called killing prepotential, which play the role of the superpotential. Two of them play the role of the superpotential, complex superpotential, plus the D term. So these are the three quantities in n equal 2 you have, which in n equal 1 language correspond to the D term and the superpotential. And so you can do exactly the same computation and compute P, if you wish, or the n equal 2 version of the superpotential. And now here, everywhere, D of omega or D of J appears, and also the fluxes appear. So this is where the torsion appears. It precisely appears in the n equal 2 version of the potential. And now again we could discuss mirror symmetry, and mirror symmetry now would be just an exchange of these two. You see, just you exchange these two, what is called, what Nigel calls pure spinners. So these are actually pure spinners of SU3, and this is the way mirror symmetry acts. I'm running out of time. Now I'm not sure, probably I should stop here. I don't know how much more I have. Now you do the Kaluza-Klein reduction, and you just now insist that the Kaluza-Klein reduction you can do in many ways, and you just insist that n equal 2 is maintained. So we'll say we can do it in any which way we want, as long as we keep this special Kähler geometry on the subspace now of a finite number. So we truncate to a finite number of modes, and we say the space of these finite number of modes, we have to do such that the special Kähler geometries descend, these 10-dimensional ones. And that is a particular condition on a non-degeneracy of the space of forms we truncate. And then you find that with this, I would tell you more details if I had more time, you find precisely that, of course, you now get the integrals over these two quantities, and you get the integrals over these quantities we discussed before.
That may or may not be different.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Let me not go through the conclusion, maybe because we're running a little late in time. Let me just stop here and ask the question.
Any questions? Urgent one before we resume. Some of us resume for the organization. Yeah.
Well, a general question, and that is, so you said, well, we talked earlier in response to this question about this hierarchy of structure. So first there's the general case where you just have spinners. Then there's the case where there's a non-zero globally defined section of the spinner bundle. And that's that implies that there is a four-dimensional supersymmetry, but then in general that's spontaneously broken. And then there's the case where the holonomy is actually three, and that in that case you have unbroken supersymmetry. So how would I interpret the first case in terms of four dimensions? So I've got, coming back up from the bottom, I've got unbroken supersymmetry, spontaneously broken. Is that somehow explicitly broken, or how do I think of that?
Say again, what was the first case? The first case was?
Okay, so starting from the top, there's the case where you just have spinners.
Yes.
Then there's the case where there's this nowhere vanishing globally defined spinner. That's
Yeah. I haven't thought about it, yeah.
There's the even more special case where you have unbroken supersymmetry. So what?
I haven't thought about it.
It's just explicit breaking.
Maybe the red spontaneous is
Or it could be somehow, I don't know, a different kind of spontaneous breaking.
You're talking about a solution of the equations of both?
Yeah, let's suppose
you're isn't that by definition spontaneous symmetry breaking? It's a solution.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
It's a solution of equations of function that come from supersymmetric Lagrangian.
Yeah, but there doesn't have to exist a 4D.
Oh, from the 10-dimensional point of view, it's
yes. Yeah, from that point of view, it is. But I'm trying to understand how to think of it. Whether there's a what's the right way of thinking about from the 4-dimensional perspective, whether it's sort of explicit or spontaneous, what?
You're saying that the effective action would be very different from the effective action. It's not just some expanding some solution, expanding around some other supersymmetric effective action. So, well, if it's not, then it's explicit.
Yeah, I was wondering if that's the distinction.
I haven't thought about it.
Well, it's just explicit.
Okay, any other question? Are these ideas, this thing you were discussing just a moment ago, related to these consistent truncations when sometimes does engage supergravities?
Yes.
Consistent truncating the 10-dimensional gravity theory to some subset of modes?
Yes.
Where you don't use an energetics reason to truncate it, you just truncate to some of the modes.
Yeah.
That's how we consistent truncation. So So is the one you discussed before a consistent truncation in the same sense? So,
that I don't know. But that, again, you need...
This theory would be a solution of the 10-dimensional theory?
I don't really know. For that, again, you need to know much more probably about the massive spectrum. I mean, here, sort of, the truncation we are proposing
what
is...
What you need to know is that these modes don't couple to other modes, right?
Yeah. So...
solution of this theory.
Yeah. Maybe one could sort of investigate it in this sort of spirit. At the moment, we just said, let's truncate, we truncate to a subset, a finite subset of modes, such that the n equal 2 relations stay intact, which basically means that the special Taylor geometry descends to that, onto that subspace. I mean, the surprise was that the special Taylor geometry, well, for me, the surprise was that you could find that special Taylor geometry in 10 dimensions, which...
Was your truncation that, in terms of actually group theory, you kept everything at a zero triality?
So I threw away all triplets, so all triplets of SU3, and the sole reason was that I wanted not to deal with massive spin 3/2 multiplets.
If you've thrown away everything with non-zero triality, then obviously it's consistent.
What do you mean by non-zero triality?
The sense in which I assign, non-zero triality means that you, you change, that it's
the center of SU3, that's not trivial.
The center of SU3, that's not trivial. Representations that occur in the root algebra.
I haven't thought about it, so. I don't know.
Did you keep the sixes or not?
I kept the sixes.
But the sixes have non-trivial triangle. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
The six is important, yes.
Okay. No other question?
Okay.
So let's
thank you.